This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Danny Lang is Associate Professor at the University of Paris 13, Paris Nord. He leads the task group on international macroeconomics and post-Keynesian analyses at the university's Center for Economics. He's the secretary of Les Economistes Atterrés, which translates as the Appalled Economists Movement, and vice president of the French Association for Political Economy. His research interests are mainly in post-Keynesian economics, including growth, income distribution, unemployment issues, path dependence, and the importance of time in economics. Jonathan Perriton is senior lecturer in economics at the University of Sheffield. His wide-ranging research interests include international macroeconomics, political economy, and methodology. He has recently been looking at longer-term factors in relation to the Great Recession and their impact on investment and employment. He's therefore very well placed to comment on this paper on the Nehru, still not an interesting rate of unemployment. And Jonathan's kindly agreed to give us that initial response to set the discussion going. So okay. Over to you, Danny.
Okay. When we start the discussion, don't forget I'm not a native speaker, so speak slowly if it's possible. So thank you, Mark. Thanks to all of you for coming and for inviting me. I'm really delighted to be here, and it is with great pleasure that I will present that paper to you. Basically, what I'm going to do is to present is a bit different from the paper, because I wanted to make the argument less technical and more accessible to the readers and the audience. So hopefully I will make myself clear, but if this is not the case, please feel free to ask any question after I make my presentation. So this paper is a paper I wrote with Rod Cross from Strathclyde University, who is well known for his critical views about the natural rate of unemployment and the Nehru and so on. And it was published last year in Intervention. So the outline of my presentation is the following one. So I have 4 points. First of all, I will try and convince you that the Nehru issue is still really topical today for various reasons. And then I will come to what is the most famous version of the Nehru. It is the one framed by Layard, Nickel, and Jackman at the end of the 1980s, the beginning of the 1990s in the UK. And then I will try and propose to you an alternative view that is called hysteresis in economics. And last but not least, I will conclude and try to show you what kind of further research can be laid on the basis of what I have presented before. So this is ambitious, and I will check the time. So first of all, why is the Nehru still topical today? And this is a Keynes seminar, so of course you all know that quotation, which is taken from chapter 24 of the General Theory, the ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences, are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. So you know that quotation, and I think that one of those powerful ideas is a Nehru, for sure. One of those powerful ideas is a Nehru, because look at it. When we look at it, it has been ruling macro for over the past 30 years. And especially the textbooks, but not only, you find it at the core of the mainstream model. And for example, if you take the really famous now new consensus model, and you know that free model equation, and when you take the so-called new Keynesian Phillips curve, what do you have? You have a long-run neighborhood in it, okay? So it has influenced the new macroeconomic consensus. I know that currently central banks are leading non-conventional policies, non-conventional meaning that the convention is the new macroeconomic consensus, but if these policies are not conventional, it means that they intend to go back to the convention after the economy has recovered. It will recover, right? So how powerful that Nehru idea is. Third point is that concept underlies and dominates all the national and international policy making. And when you look at the publication of institutions like the IMF, the OECD, and the European Union, I think this is pretty clear. So this is another quotation, but that one is not from Keynes. It's from a book that has been published last year by Storm and Nesterpad about the issue, macroeconomics beyond the Nehru. And I think that this quotation is really interesting because this is exactly what I intend to do. Just by the way, if it's too quick, you can write to me later and I will send you the slide. No? So the quotation is, not only is the teaching of Nehru-based macroeconomics misleading, but attempting to apply it to practice is economically and socially disastrous. The cost of Nehru-Viennese macroeconomic policy are very large and avoidable. It is our objective to persuade fellow economists to re-examine critically the basic assumption of their core theory. So this is also my aim here. This was my aim in that paper, but also in other papers. So what are the consequences of Nehruvianism? That's hard to say, yeah? Nehruvianism, for macroeconomic policies and the labor market. Let me state that really clearly. I know that most of you already know that, but let me state that really clearly. The first consequence is for the fiscal and the monetary policies. And that consequences can be called Friedman's ineffectiveness theorem, according to which fiscal and monetary policies can have permanent effect on the unemployment rate because it is natural or structural. Okay, so therefore, all the efforts that can be implemented in order to push the current rate of unemployment below the Nehru will imply accelerating inflation. Basically, the mechanisms are really simple. You need to print money, and in order to implement these economic policies, and this printed money will imply higher wages, higher prices through labor and product market adjustments. So first, for the fiscal and the monetary policy. But Nehruvianism has also consequences for the labor market because if the monetary and fiscal expansionary policy cannot do anything about unemployment, therefore, if you want to bring unemployment down, you need to reform the labor market. You have to make it more flexible through deregulation policies. You have to remove the so-called rigidities. You have to end up what Bertola and Bettinola would call eurosclerosis. And according to that view, actual unemployment is due to real wages that are too high and too rigid. And that's because of the labor market regulations, it's because of the redistributive intervention, is because of the employment protection legislation, high taxation, social welfare states, and so on. And if you look at the current mainstream literature about unemployment, that's the kind of determinants that you find in the so-called matching models, you know, a la Pissarides. Okay, for example, Pissarides or Saint-Paul or people like that. are developing this kind of analysis. So, two consequences for the macro policies and for the labor market. And of course, the two are related. So therefore, that modern Nehruvianist theory ignores Kant's objections regarding the second postulate of the neoclassical theory of employment. You know about this, the fact that the adjustment of real wages cannot bring down full employment, fully impossible. You know about this. You're familiar with that. That theory uses the failed metaphor of an aggregative labor market. Okay, you know, there were lots of objections about his view that the labor market is a market like the others, it's aggregative and so on. There have been very good papers by Tobin about that, for example, in the 70s. And that theory also has major and disastrous consequences, because when you think about it, think about the supply-side policies that are implemented today, the austerity policies, the so-called internal devaluations in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and it's also coming in France, the austerity program, the increased flexibility on the labor market, etc., etc., justified by the idea that in the long run, what can change the unemployment rate is not fiscal and monetary policies, but policies aimed at changing these so-called determinants of the money. So hopefully you are now convinced, and we'll discuss that later. But then, now it's time to go to my second part. So I will take a quick look at the paper by Layard, Nickel, and Jackman. And what we have done is taking a look at various papers and also the book, the famous book that was published in 1991. And because we think that when you look at the current literature, that's still the main reference. There may be other references, but in a worst-case scenario, that book is really representative of the way the current mainstreams see the Nehru issue. These people, in fact, they make a clear distinction between the short run and the long run Nehru. So there would be two kinds of Nehrus, one in the short run and one in the long run. And in fact, the long run Nehru, USAR, is meant to be determined only by supply side factors, okay, like the natural rate of unemployment. There is no difference between the two concepts. When you look really closely, it's roughly the same. So that is the rate of unemployment that is consistent with stable inflation and correct price and wage expectations. That is the first one. But they introduce another concept, and that's a little bit different from what you could see before them. They introduced a short-run Nehru, USAR. And that short-run Nehru is said to be stable, is said to be consistent with stable inflation within the current time period. So, therefore, that short-run Nehru can be influenced by short-run demand factors and is said to be subject to hysteresis. And I will go back in a few seconds to how these people define hysteresis. So here are some quotations. So this is the first quotation about the long-run Nehru. And what they say here, they say explicitly that it is a little bit like the natural rates. It's similar. It looks like the natural rates. So I don't really need a quotation. I will give you the slides for the people listening to us. And here is another quotation about the short-term Nehru. But first of all, what I must say is that short-term Nehru emerged as a consequence of an empirical refutation. And this is really interesting. And what was happening, the country here, is the UK. What happened in the UK from 82 to 87 is when you look at the so-called determinants of the Nauru, okay, and especially the wage pressure index. When you look at that, as a result of Margaret Thatcher's policy, it goes down. It goes down a lot, empirically. So, if you take the natural rate story seriously, that means that the gap between the current rate of unemployment and the natural rate of unemployment was increasing during that time. Okay? Because U star was decreasing. So in that case, you should have deflation if you are consistent with Friedman's theory. You should have deflation. The price are supposed to go down in that case. Okay? Well, U was below U star, if you take this story seriously. But as a matter of fact, over the same period, what you have had in the UK is stable prices. So that's not compatible with the Nauru story. In the Nauru story, if U is below U star, prices are meant to decrease. But this is an issue for the Nauru story. Well, that's why they come to short-run Nauru, okay, to make the model compatible with the facts in the UK at the beginning of the 80s. Yeah, because there was a problem. So that's why they come the story. So basically, the model is really simple. Today, we will call that a WSPS framework. The WSPS framework is a bit different, but not as different as it seems, so it's close. And the first equation they use, it's what we could call a PS equation, a price setting equation. So P is the log of the price level, W is the log of the nominal wages, and then on the right-hand side of the equation, U is unemployment, delta U is the variation of unemployment, and then you have that last term here, which is meant to represent the acceleration of inflation. Okay, the innovation here is that you have the variation of unemployment in the short run. And then you have the second equation, which is a wage setting equation. We can call it a WS equation, saying how the real wage is determined, so the difference between the nominal wage and the price level in logs. So it's determined by the unemployment rate, it's determined by the variation of unemployment, it's determined by accelerating prices, and it's determined by a Z variable, and that Z variable is the index of wage pressure I was talking about. Okay, you can find data on that. Well, so the innovation here, what they call hysteresis here, is simply the fact that they have introduced delta U in both equations. If you remove delta U, if you say delta U is equal to zero, in that case, it boils down to the usual natural rate model. Okay? Well, so they say in their own definition, they say that the economy reaches the long-run Nauru when expectations about wages and prices are fulfilled. And here, it means that the delta square P term is equal to the difference between prices and expected prices and wages and expected wages. And meaning that expectations are correct and the inflation rate will be constant. And if you remove that hysteresis, so-called hysteresis term, that is, if you set delta U to zero, then you find a long-run Nauru that really looks like the natural rate of unemployment. Okay, it's exactly the same thing. that is the expression here. So what is the difference in the short run Nehru? You have this delta U, so it is variation of unemployment. And I define it, as I said before, as the level of unemployment which is consistent with stable inflation during the current period. So it is a temporary equilibrium, they say. And they say it's not sustainable in the long run because of the hysteresis effect arise from delta U different from zero in the short run. It is not sustainable in the long run because in the short run you have delta U which is different from zero. So if you look at the short run Nehru, the only difference with the long run Nehru is that you have that delta U. You have that delta U, and so you have a close relationship between the short run and the long run Nehru, but as long as delta U is equal to zero, you find the same expression. So that's the delta U is the only difference between the long run and the short run Nehru. Okay, and they say that this delta U represents hysteresis. Hysteresis. So how they justify it, I skip it because it's already 20 minutes. They say it represents hysteresis, so I will go back to what hysteresis means in a few minutes. But it's a kind of path dependence. Okay. So what are the issues with these layered nickel and Jackman approach? In that paper, we say that there are two major issues with that approach. The first thing is that they postulate. They don't demonstrate. They postulate that hysteresis influences only the short-run Nehru. It's an hypothesis. It's based on nothing else than a single hypothesis. They say it. Okay? They don't demonstrate anything. They say, okay, in the short run, hysteresis influences on Nehru, but in the long run, we go back to the old, well-known natural rate story. And the second issue is that we don't have a clue why hysteresis would arise here. They just add that delta U term without really justifying it. Why would we have delta U? Because the theory doesn't match the facts, so they don't really justify that. And they don't address the issue whether this short-run Nehru is consistent with a non-hysteretic long-run Nehru. There's nothing about that in the paper. They just say, okay, there is a short-run Nehru different from long-run Nehru. The difference is hysteresis. Hysteresis exists in the short-run. That's it. Okay, you can go to bed then and to accept what we have said. And there are other issues, further issues with that long-run Nehru, and I must apologize to you because that's not in the paper, but we need to mention them. One of the issues with this kind of models that has been underlined, amongst others, by Amtavadat, is that these models, a la Layard, Nickel, and Jackman, are really closed. They are closed models. The models end up in a position which is fully determined by the structure of the model. So these models are fully closed. So there is no space here for human will or human freedom or whatsoever. The long-run position is fully determined. Another issue with that kind of model is the notion of a stable long-run Nehru. So if you have a long-run stable Nehru, forget about chance and true uncertainty and so on. You only have risk then. You don't have true uncertainty if there is a long-run Nehru. And if you have a long-run Nehru, you can forget about increasing returns. And my guess is that increasing returns in some sectors is an interesting feature, right, But if you have a long-run NAIHU, you cannot have increasing returns. And another issue, and that one is empirical, is that if we take meta-analysis seriously, you know, meta-analysis is is a technique that is used by the pharmacist, and it's also used in medicine to compare the studies that are led, empirical studies that are led on a particular topic. For example, are antidepressants efficient or not? You have different studies, and it's an empirical technique to put different studies together and to compare them. Well, Tom Stanley in the US did that with the NAIHU. He took all the papers published on the NAIHU, basically, and he put them in his statistical framework and came to a really clear-cut conclusion. He took, I think, 200 papers or something like that. And the conclusion is clear. The NAIHU does not exist. So it doesn't hold empirically. So that's another issue. We don't refer to this issue in the paper, but these are further issues with the NAIHU. Well, let me now move to the third part. So there are issues with the Layard, Nickel, and Jackman presentation, the issue within the paper, but the issue also I mentioned outside of the papers or next to the papers. But is it really hysteresis? So basically, we talk about hysteresis when the effects are still there, when the cause has disappeared. So that's a really loose and broad definition of hysteresis. But if you look at this, at the definition in biology, in physics, and in other sciences, hysteresis refers to something which is really specific. And if you want to talk about hysteresis, then you have to look at what physicists and biologists have done and mean by that. And when you look closely, hysteresis doesn't mean at all that you just add delta U into WS and PS equations. If you take that seriously, then you have only one form of proper hysteresis, what Goecke has called genuine hysteresis in a 2003 paper. And what is the definition? So it is a form of path dependency, and as clinicians we know that path dependency is important, especially you have lots of quotation by Joan Robinson, and I refer to this quotation in a paper published with Marx in 2008. And so path dependency is crucial for economic policies because, as you know, if outcomes, the final outcomes, are path dependent, then what happens along the path will determine the final outcome, in which case economic policies will be able to affect the final outcome, which is not the case in the NAIHU models. Okay? And so that's general consideration about path dependency. But what is the so-called genuine hysteresis definition? But if you look at what is done in this paper, then if you have genuine hysteresis, then the equilibria, because they are necessarily multiple, that will be reached by the system in the medium run and the long run will change as the short run equilibrium changes. You see, here is a first difference with the so-called hysteresis model of Layard, Nickel, and Jackman, because if you have proper hysteresis, you don't have a stable NAIHU in the long run. And therefore, if you have proper hysteresis, nominal shocks, demand shocks, or economic policy shocks, monetary policies, fiscal policies, will be able to influence the long-run outcomes. So they will have long-lasting effects on the economy, and the long-run unemployment rate in the equilibrium will be affected by the path taken, which means that history matters, as Robinson would put it. So I will not take too long on these models. I will try to make it really simple because I only have 12 minutes left. But what is interesting in the presence of genuine hysteresis is that you have micro foundations, but not the usual micro foundations in terms of rigidities there, wedge rigidities, press. You don't have these so-called new Keynesian stories. These micro foundations are not based on intertemporal optimization, but these micro foundations are based on decision making under true uncertainty, which is really interesting for a post-Keynesian seminar, I think. And also they are based upon discontinuous adjustments. And another interesting thing here, I think that as economists we always have to think about this. These micro foundations, these models can be tested empirically. And there are methods for that, and recent papers, and especially a seminal paper by Cross, P.C. Kelly, and his people in 2000. Well, so I will tell a few words about this historic model really quickly. The two main properties, if you have genuine hysteresis, is the first property is remanence, meaning that if you apply two shocks of the same size to the economy, it will never get back to the same equilibrium. Think about Friedman's interpretation of the long-run Phillips curve. If you implement a monetary policy, an expansionary monetary policies, and the unemployment rate goes down, but in the long run, expectations will adjust, and then you go back to the natural rate of unemployment. And then if you implement a restrictive monetary policy of the same size, in the long run, you also revert to the same rate of unemployment. That does not happen with genuine hysteresis because you have remnants. So the system never goes back to its initial position. And you also have a selective memory. This is interesting because in the 80s, following the work by Blanchard, Summers, and people like that, you had that loose definition of hysteresis that you also find in Layard, Nickel, and Jackman, where the memory in the short run was elephantine. So every single small shock happening in the economy would be remembered by the short-run equilibrium rate of unemployment. And that's not realistic. With genuine hysteresis, only the most important shocks will matter, and the economy will forget about the so-called dominated shocks, the small shocks. So what you need basically is the basic story in a nutshell, in a few words. You need heterogeneous agents. Here in my example, these are heterogeneous firms. In the paper, these are heterogeneous markets. You need a context of true uncertainty, okay? Because, for example, where the capitalists don't know what the future will look like in the general theory, because they have no rational basis for constructing a distribution of probability and blah, 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 blah. You know the story. And in that story, the firms will become active or inactive depending on some input variable. It could be the rate of capacity utilization. It could be growth. There need to be positive or negative shocks on some of the variables, for example, it can be demand too. And so the agents are different. Each of them has two switching values. So I will skip the details and show you graphically because, so that's a basic firm within the hysteresis model. It's really basic, but think about it. That firm has two threshold values. A is the value that is needed for getting on. Okay, if you go over the A threshold, the firm starts to produce. So if you are under it, it's closed, and then if you go over that threshold, then it produces and employs people. Okay? And then think about it, a real firm in the real world. Then all of a sudden, the situation in the economy gets worse. And the firm has just opened up. So it won't close the door immediately. Okay? So there is another threshold when the situation gets worse for closing this time. So the requirements for hysteresis to happen is just that firms don't act at the same level. They have two different thresholds, one for starting to produce, one for closing down. Not really unrealistic, right? So here is how it works. And if you are between B and A, you have an inaction zone. Well, you don't open up, you don't close, and therefore where you are depends on where you were before. If the threshold A has been crossed, then you will be on the lower branch. If the threshold A has not been crossed, then you will be on the lower branch, okay? Or if threshold B has been crossed. But if you have crossed threshold A, but then the negative shock was less than B, then you are on the upper branch. So history matters. To know where you are here, you must know what has happened in the past. Otherwise, you cannot determine whether the firm produces or not. So history matters at the micro level. But at the macro level, then you will find really interesting property. As long as you assume that you have lots of firms, which is not a big assumption, right? All the firms are characterized by their A and B threshold values, and all of them are heterogeneous, meaning that the A's and the B's are not the same for all these firms. And then you can represent all the firms within that so-called Meyer-Gods diagram, where each dot represents a firm, because a firm is determined by A and B, the threshold values. Okay. And then what is interesting is that you can represent how the macroeconomy behaves inside of that diagram. So depending on the past, you have two zones. A is for the active firms that are currently producing, so employing people, and NA is for the non-active firms, so that will correspond to unemployed people in the economy. And it can be shown that there is a staircase partition between the two, which is determined by the past positive and negative shock in the economy. And it can also be shown, I don't really have the time, but we can go back to that in the discussion, that this staircase partition can be erased by really big shock in the economy. So the memory will be selective. Not all shocks are kept within the memory of the economy. So the selective memory, I already told you about that. The remanence effect, I also told you about that. What is interesting here, the macro level, is that if you have a positive shock, as I told you before, followed of a negative shock of the same size, you don't go back to the same equilibrium. So you don't have a long run narrow like in the Layer, Nickel and Jackman model. Okay? You don't go back to the same position if you have two shocks of the same size within the economy. So that's interesting, so I skip this, and it's time to come to my conclusion, right?
Yes.
So Our point in that paper is that what Leyard, Nickel and Jackman call partial hysteresis is not hysteresis at all. I hope this is clear to you. And our point is also that hysteresis, if we take that seriously, implies a permanent through selective memory of the input shocks that have hit the economy, the negative and the positive one. And in that case, you don't only have short-run effects, but also long-run effects of shocks and macroeconomic policies. And if it is true that we have genuine hysteresis, it means that at some stage, the non-conventional policies, or some non-conventional policies, should become the convention in some kind of way. Not necessarily this one, but we shouldn't revert to the new consensus model where you have this long-run so-called NIRU. So, a few clues about further research that can be led about this. I have, with Mark Setfield, we have taken recently a look at all the recent empirical papers about the NIRU. And guess what? We find something which is really close to what we found in that paper. But these are in the empirical papers. We found that the people trying to test for the existence of a long-run NIRU impose dynamic homogeneity in the Phillips curve. And basically, that means that they suppose, rather than proving, that the Phillips curve in the long run is vertical. They suppose it, and then they run the test. If you impose dynamic, I don't have time for talking about this, it's a bit frustrating, but maybe I will come back and present the paper another time. But if you look at the empirical papers, it's pretty clear. They suppose, exactly like Leyer, Nickel and Jackman did in their theoretical paper, they do that in empirical papers. And the second point I would like to emphasize here, just to conclude, is the recent developments in the agent-based literature is really interesting. I don't know whether you are familiar with this new agent-based model, but I think at some stage I thought, okay, I have done my thesis on hysteresis, I've wrote papers, I published papers, but what now? I need to move to some other things. That's why I started working on the collection models and so on. And then I saw these agent-based models. And you have some of these agent-based models that are based on a quite Keynesian framework, where the capitalists really don't know what the future will hold. So they have to decide in a world of true uncertainty. And that's really interesting, because if we take the story seriously, then we'll have hysteresis in investment. So we really, it's worth taking a look at this, because they have bounded rationality, they have limited information about how the whole economy is doing, so they're unable to construct the distribution of probability and so on. So this is really interesting, and I think that hysteresis will be necessarily found within this kind of models. And I think we have to look at this and to do our work on that also in the forthcoming year. So, okay, it's already 42 minutes, so I'm sorry. I'm a bit late, but thank you.
Thank you. Jonathan.
Well, thank you very much, Danny. It's Danny's paper, not mine, so I don't want to hog the time of discussion here. But I'll start by saying I think it's a very neat and succinct paper, and it's particularly pertinent at this time, I think. In response to the crisis since 2008, many economists have diagnosed causes and they've prescribed remedies. Their diagnoses of prescriptions may be quite reasonable, but as A number of people have observed the great and the good in the economics profession have been making pronouncements recently on these matters that do not obviously have basis in their prior work. So that many people, there are many economists who have used variants of this framework currently advocating, broadly speaking, Keynesian-type measures, which I don't have an objection to, but it's quite hard to see how the measures that they're currently advocating can be reconciled with the sort of work they've done in this approach in the past. And if you're going to say, without wishing to put words in their mouth, that what has been faced now is not a regular shock, if you like, but is a particularly abnormal negative shock, and that requires somehow extraordinary measures, then effectively you're conceding we're in the world that this paper explores, where past extreme shocks have key effects on the evolution of the economy. It seems to me that if that's the line that Nehru theorists are going to take, they've effectively conceded a lot of the ground to where Danny's paper and work of that ilk is coming from. So I think it's a particularly pertinent paper at the moment because it not just sets out both conceptually and empirically what the problems with the Nehru framework are, but raises at a time in which implicitly, at least, it seems to me that question marks have been raised over this whole framework and how we go forward to it. It's astonishing, both conceptually and empirically, as Danny raises some of the problems. That there's some antecedents in some of the points that Danny has made. It's not quite the same. It's not exactly the same point, but a similar sort of point that Robert Gordon made in the paper some years ago. Because he's quickly trying to check the date of this. Some years ago,
1990,
where he says, "Is a seemingly small matter of shifting one derivative has profound implications for both economic doctrine and policy." And when we're covering sort of similar ground here, and Danny points out effectively, that, of course, if you have a situation in which unemployment is above its Nehru rate, you should get deflation. One can argue the toss. It's a moot point about whether he really got accelerating inflation when unemployment appeared to be above some Nehru rate, whether that really occurred. You can argue the toss about that. But deflation from unemployment being below some Nehru rate, you have to search pretty hard in the historical record to find any instances that looked like that. And it's not, as you were suggesting from surveying the empirical work, it's not part of what happened here was in response to empirical problems with trying to implement this model in the 1980s in the UK, but there are empirical anomalies all over the place, not just in the UK, when the trends in terms of labour market institutions, real wage developments and so on were not consistent with what the Nehru framework would suggest, and that the Macroeconomics Beyond the Nehru Framework book that we've already mentioned has a good deal of examples of this. So, I guess my main comments are mostly tentative on this. I think part of the problem that you are getting at here, I don't think there's anything that hopefully you'll disagree with, is part of the real problem here is this almost single-minded focus on the labour market. And I think this is problematic for a number of reasons, that the levels of output and output and employment are effectively determined in the labour market, and that's your sole focus of interest in determining this and policy towards it. And you throw up in a number of different ways why that may be problematic. And not just no uncertainty, but ruling out increasing returns to scale, so rule out issues of production, investment, and so on. And this, in various ways, it seems to be rather problematic, even in terms of where work in what you might broadly characterise mainstream economics is going. If one looks at the work of around growth, trade theory, and so on, then the whole issues including what I have problems with this, but this is not the forum, but including what might loosely be called neo-Schumpeterian work. We are here very much in the world of creative destruction, increasing returns to scale, heterogeneous ferns which respond in different ways to shocks and so on. There's a whole body of literature out there, even within broadly mainstream economics, that is raising all these sorts of issues, which then when you go over elsewhere, sometimes including in the same macroeconomics textbook, I might add, no names, no patria, and not marrying up to this single-minded focus that everything is simply determined in labour market context with essentially homogenous representative firms and so on. As a number of authors have noticed, capital and investment effects are systematically downplayed in this, which will be part of the story that you're moving on to. The hysteresis effects in terms of what is happening to unemployment are, in this vision, overwhelmingly discussed in terms of labour search, discouraged workers, firms being biased against hiring the long-term unemployed. There's a very narrow focus on where hysteresis in unemployment specifically might arise from these sorts of issues, and there may be a certain amount of this measured to try and get the long-term unemployed back into work if they can be devised effectively, is not something I'm going to raise any objections to. But it seems to me it's a rather narrow focus that completely ignores, as Danny raised, issues around the capital stock and investment, as of course have made that point as well. I guess if I was playing devil's advocate, there is the sort of Blanchard-Summers line where they attribute hysteresis here to being an insider-outsider effects in the labour market, and that ultimately can get you back to a reform of the labour market story. I say I'm not really here to play devil's advocate for the narrow story here. I guess that's a line of defence. I guess that one could take you. If one particularly wished to. There's an important sense in one of the great strengths actually of your paper is that it's very clean and doesn't prioritise any particular underlying vision or model of the determinants of unemployment. It's sufficiently general, which I think on balance is, there are some issues that I think this raises in terms of where you go for future research, but it's not nailed to a particular model of the determinants of unemployment. And therefore, this approach can be compatible, as I think you were suggesting in the end, with a variety of different stories and visions of what determines unemployment. This then opens up some issues which the Nehru model attempts to nail down, although essentially I'm going to agree with the reasons why it doesn't do so terribly satisfactorily in a way that's ultimately sustainable. But one might think about through how one would work through these issues in the framework that you're approaching. In the standard Nehru model, in a sense what you've got is a vision of what I think Blanchard somehow calls the Battle of the Markups. And that will grind out workers trying to defend their real wages, firms trying to protect their profit margins. That will grind out some level of income distribution, which the Nehru sits on top of. Now, that isn't to defend the Nehru model. I mean, one of the points of doing theory, after all, is to take some hunchy suppositions of how the world might work and crank through it to see how robust or generalisable or fragile those are. And one of the things you do rather effectively in this paper is that an awful lot gets smuggled into the Nehru as if it's robust, defendable on conceptual and empirical grounds, and of course it's not. and the vision in Nehru that gives you neat solutions hides under it a great deal of sins. However, if you do get shocks, and I'll come on to something about shocks in a moment. If you do get shocks in the nature of your system, they would presumably expect to have significant impact on functional income effects. They would affect real wages. They would affect profits. And presumably agents would then respond in some shape or form by doing something about it. With consequences might go. Now, of course, as I say, one of the neat, in many ways attractive features of what you've done so far is it leaves open a variety of different stories and approaches as to how you might deal with those questions. So, for example, this is not necessarily a strong advocation of this, but for example, one route that has been gone down with is to suggest essentially a framework of, in the short to medium run, Goodwin cycles, which extreme shocks may periodically shift you into a different plane. That seems to me is one route that's quite compatible with what you've done. This is really tentative. I kind of want to know what shocks mean in what we're doing here, because I know what shocks mean. Shocks mean in the Nehru framework. At least I think I do, which doesn't mean that I'm necessarily terribly happy with it. The Nehru framework says we understand what happens when agents' expectations are realised, and therefore, based on a relatively mainstream modelling of expectations, then, well, stuff happens. Stuff that you can't predict, but has a structure in terms of the statistical properties of shocks that it broadly follows from mainstream conceptions of shocks periodically happens. And that leads to the nature of the model. It leads to things like DSG modelling versions of these, where just set up the model, give it some shock from outside and see what happens. Now, implicit in what I've said and also what you've said is problems that we might have with that is conception of shocks. It kind of makes sense conceptually in the world in which Nehru inhabits. Now, given everything you've said about Keynesian uncertainty, and I come from that tradition, in one sense I have no problem with things coming along that happen and people didn't foresee and couldn't foresee, and that happens a lot in the world, and there's no harm in having the conception of economics where that sort of thing happens. In another sense, though, I kind of, once one is out of a Nehru-type framework, I still want to think about sort of what we... I mean, it seems to me shocks in the Nehru framework are a bit of a cop-out, you know. We've got a nice, neat system, and the only way of making something happen is to say some random, unexpected event happens periodically. I think there is both a positive and negative space here, really, to think, building on ideas of Keynesian uncertainty and so on, about what we really understand and what we really understand shocks to be. Because clearly this is particularly important in terms of the conception, because in terms of your language of what shocks are, shocks absolutely crucially include, in your conception of it, policy interventions that could be used to affect the outcome in a desirable way. We have multiple equilibria. Some in welfare senses inevitably are going to be better than others. This gets you a long way to a position where we can think about engineering shocks, if you like, and engineering shocks that will get us to a better place rather than a worse place. But I still think as I say, this is I'm very aware that this is distinctly tentative. I still think we need to think about what we mean by shocks in a world where we need to be clear here that our conception of shocks is an important way different from the notion of shocks that is embedded within and makes sense within the Nehru approach. And that's particularly important, ultimately, in a sense, to reiterate what I've just said, to fleshing out this notion that it's possible to engineer policy shocks that would get you to a better place than you would otherwise be. So wrapping up what I'm trying to say here is thanks very much for the paper. Recommend everybody go away, read it, digest its contents. As I say, I think it's a particularly timely intervention. I'm not wildly optimistic, but it's conceivably a bit of policy space where, as I said, perhaps it is possible to point out that relatively mainstream economists, even Pissarides, I believe, recent pronouncement on macro policy, not desperately unreasonable to my biased Keynesian mind. As I said, there is plenty of stuff going on in growth theory that I wouldn't particularly wish to fully sign up to, but it seems to me there is a distinctly different world from the Nehru world. And as you have pointed out, there are, as the macroeconomics beyond the Nehru book points out, and others, there are very effectively pointed out that the Stanley work on better analysis, there is any number of empirical problems that the numbers simply just don't come out, even when this is probably not the space to discuss econometric testing, but we might actually think that standard tests will probably be biased towards accepting the Nehru hypothesis rather than biased against it, and even so it still doesn't come out. Kind of, what more do you need to knock a paradigm off its perch?